Welcome back to Well Talks with Dr. Rob Rapone, not a doctor, Aaron Shokron. And for the first time, we have an interviewed guest is Dr. Ryan Shakitano. He's going to talk to us about his book that he just wrote, and we'll see where else the conversation takes us. But he is a great doctor and a colleague of mine. We went to school together, and I'm excited to have him on.
Excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Perfect. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, like Dr. Rapone is saying, I'm Dr. Ryan Shakitano. I'm a naturopathic doctor, certified strength and conditioning specialist, certified sports nutritionist, recently published author, so I'll tell you guys all about my book, and we'll get into some things.
Awesome. And he's also a soccer player, great shape, this guy's everything, whole package.
I was wondering how long it would take for you to hit on me during this.
I forgot to do it right off the bat, I had to get it in. You brought your book in, which is great. Great picture.
Thank you.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about like what made you write it, and then we'll get into some of what's in the book.
You got it. Yeah, I've gotten a lot of compliments on that cover for sure.
It's a little distracting.
Yeah, actually, to say the least. His butt.
I will not share. I will not share what it is.
It's a secret.
Yeah. My background behind the book was more from my soccer background. So, growing up, I played soccer my whole life, as Rob knows. Played in a bunch of different places. I was in Italy for a year, came back here, played at the University of Toronto, went on to do some pretty cool things, but along the way I was injured throughout, unfortunately. But along the way, because of that, I got to learn some pretty cool things. So going into my third year at the University of Toronto, my main goal was to improve my long distance passing in soccer. So hitting balls 50, 60 yards, part of that was being predominantly right footed. So unbeknownst to me, my pelvis and sacrum ended up shifting. I was getting compression in the nerves going into my legs. A lot of pain, numbness, tingling. Misdiagnosed at the time by a world-renowned doctor who said, listen, this is a herniated disc. Take 6 weeks off. Do nothing. You can come back after that. So as an athlete, as you guys know, like if you want to be active and someone says don't do anything, it's like, shit, this is
worst
painful. Oh my God. It was absolutely painful. But I did it. And then I came back and wasn't really the same. Like I didn't really feel like myself on the field. I was still dealing with pain, still dealing with numbness. I had to miss some games, so it was a little bit painful. And then made it through the season, took a couple months off, came back and the following year, and I was like, do I even want to play? Like, am I doing like lifelong damage to my back? Like, I think I have a herniated disc that's like not healing for whatever reason. So end up saying, you know what, I'll stick it out, see what happens. And we ended up with the University of Toronto having an exhibition game against one of the academy teams at Toronto FC, who was coached by Danny Dicchio at the time. Shout out to Danny Dicchio. Awesome guy, awesome coach.
Sure,
yeah. he ended up recruiting me a few weeks later after that game, and then ended up making his team, which at the time was one step below the first team. So I'm like close to fulfilling my lifelong dream. I'm like, I work so hard. About a week before that season started with Toronto FC Academy, I end up having a re-aggravation of symptoms. Low back flares up, tingling, you name it. So I'm like, shit, am I going to have to say like goodbye to a dream that I've had my whole life because of something that... And like, I work so hard to try and get to the bottom of it and nothing, right? So I go and see an athletic therapist at the time who's working with Toronto FC. At that point, he was studying. He was in his fourth year at the naturopathic school that me and Rob went to. And he said, look, I'm about 80% sure it's not your disc. I said, okay, that's good to hear. Did the most thorough assessment I'd ever had done on me, and within a week had me pain-free, no numbness, no tingling. And I thought I was going to be out for 6 weeks minimum. So I was ready for that season opener, and then a couple months later, I made my pro debut for Toronto FC against Liverpool.
Yeah, pretty damn sweet debut.
Yeah, well, and to go from like thinking I was never going to play again to playing in front of 33,000 people was like incredible.
Yeah. He has a picture in his basement, I've seen it.
Yeah, the jersey's all framed. My parents are, like, super proud, so they have to, like, we're getting this jersey framed.
The jersey, yeah.
My mom was all proud. She was like, I got the grass stains out of it. Like, it looks great. Thanks, Mom. Appreciate it.
Play hard.
Yeah, that's it, exactly. So that's dedicated to them. That's in my house, framed, ready to go. But I thought, because of that, it's like, okay, what else could be happening because the hips and the glutes are off? Like, essentially, I didn't have that pelvic stability that I needed to meet the demands of my sport. And I wish I knew that, like, in my teenage years and been able to prevent all this stuff from happening, but I learned a lot because of it. So that was kind of like the background of why I wrote the book. So the book itself has, I was like, you know what, let's have some fun with this. So the first chapter is like the scientific reason behind why us humans were attracted to butts. There's
we didn't say the title.
Oh no, we didn't. You can go ahead and
it's called A Butt to Behold.
Yes. And if you see the cover, you'll know why it's called A Butt to Behold.
Because it's his butt.
Yeah.
I can't wait till people Google the cover.
Yeah, exactly. yeah, so it's anything you can think of that is related to butt is in this book. And it also comes with a 30-day program where you can go through and improve your butt health, your butt appearance, and it'll just improve your both athletic performance and day-to-day functionality, because your butt is that important, as I learned through my soccer days. You don't need to be an athlete to need this. Like, this is, I tried to make it for everyday performance as well. So,
one of the, I'm actually very glad you're he's actually the one demonstrating all the exercises in the book, which I actually think is amazing, because as a trainer, the people who talk to me most about their butts are girls.
Yes.
One of the things that blows my mind is that rarely to basically never do I hear a guy ever say anything about their butt. It's quads, chest,
yes,
biceps, and back. Like, there's nothing involved with glutes in their repertoire of exercises,
right,
for the most part anyways. Now, what would you tell the audience now, the guys? Obviously, the women listening are already captivated by, we're talking about butts and how to get it bigger.
Yeah.
But can you stress to our audience why glutes are so important? Like, what?
It's absolutely huge. Like, I'll give you an example. So, had a patient, one of my athletes, come to my clinic with what I thought was medial meniscus tear. We later confirmed that via imaging. But I, as naturopaths, we're very good, I find, at taking a step back and being like, okay, what's causing this, or why is this happening? Like, what factors are leading to you put excess force on that meniscus,
mm-hmm,
that led to the straw that broke the camel's back? Because it was a non-contact injury. So I said, okay, I'll treat your meniscus. I think that's what it is. So we went ahead and did that. But I said, okay, let's see what's going on here. So I tested his hip range of motion, and he was severely lacking on that side in multiple ranges, especially internal hip rotation. So on top of, like, having a lack of stability in, like, just single leg balance, like, it was terrible on one side. A lot of that has to do with glute strength, glute range of motion, of course. So part of the plan was obviously to address the meniscus, but it's also, okay, let's prevent this from happening in the future by correcting some of the causative factors that were involved. And this is, like, there are research articles on why the hips are so involved. Like, there's even another one with ankle sprains that I saw, where if your gluteus medius, one of your glute muscles, is weak, you're more prone to ankle sprains on that,
mm-hmm,
leg. So I the reasons are endless, like, why your glutes and hips are so connected. The more I read about it, the more I, like, implement it in practice, the more I see it. It's like, people get better when their hip range of motion improves and their glute strength improves.
I like what you mentioned there, not just with the strength, but the range of motion.
Yes.
Because I don't know how many people I tell daily to stretch. And it seems like this passing thing, like, oh yeah, we all know we should stretch, but it is so important.
Yes.
And not enough people do it.
Yes.
That's why I like yoga, just because I like to be active and be getting stronger at the same time. But yoga has those holding poses and stretches. It's fantastic.
Yes.
For all of that.
Yes.
But can you just stress to anybody listening the importance,
yes,
of the stretch? Like, tell us about that stiffness you were talking about.
Yeah, oh, 100%. And like you said, yoga can be great for people. In part because you are stretching, you are increasing your range of motion, but you're also very much working in those poses. So you're sort of teaching your body how to use those new ranges of motion as you're doing it. So it's sort of like cements it in your brain that your body needs to be strong in those ranges. Like, if you stretch and you only stretch, I find, like, you stretch for 30 seconds, your range increases for 30 seconds, and then it goes back to the way it was before. Unless you do it, like, all the time, which,
mm-hmm,
as humans, we're not the best when it comes to being, like, very regimented with stretching.
Oh.
Yeah. So I find something like yoga or something along those lines can really help not only increase your range of motion, but sustain that range of motion, as long as it's done properly and, like, under supervision. Because I've seen people do yoga and I'm like, you should not be doing that. But yeah, that's critical, like you said.
Yeah, the range of motion is so important. It's not just about strengthening, but you,
yes,
need to have that flexibility first.
Yes.
Because you're not going to be doing the exercises properly.
Exactly.
It's the whole thing.
Yes.
But I'm glad that you mentioned that as one of the first things, even right off the bat. That
Definitely.
Was great.
Yeah.
I just want to go back to what you were saying before, actually, about how you were treated. So what was it, if you don't mind sharing,
yep,
exactly that kind of flipped that switch for you. I think it was Dr. Bennett.
Yeah, it was Matt Bennett. Exactly.
You've told me about him in the past. He's great.
He's awesome, yeah.
What was it that he did differently? Not just in assessment, but what did he have you doing that fixed that pain?
He looked at my pelvis and looked at the structure of it and said, okay, you are off in these ranges. Tested my rotation of my hips, saw you were limited in these ranges. Here are the exercises you're going to need to do to help correct that. On top of that, he's doing local acupuncture to help with some of the pain, some of the muscle tension. He did a few small adjustments around the pelvis to help realign things. But at the end of the day, if you don't go ahead and address what's causing it like we've talked about, then you're going to be stuck in square one, essentially. So he sort of put the onus on me, which I loved. Like, as an athlete, I absolutely loved that. It's like, okay, this is what you're responsible for. You do this, you'll get better. And it's like, yep, I'm doing that, right?
And after struggling for so long.
Exactly. Like, yeah. I just needed someone to say, this is what you need to do, do it. And I was all on board. So there was a few different stretches I had to do and a few different strengthening exercises I had to do, which are have now become, like, fundamental in a sense and part of the program in the book and part of what I'll run a lot of my patients through. But it's all about that stability around the hips and the range of motion in that hip joint itself.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And had that been your first kind of encounter with alternative medicine?
It was. Yeah. Awesome. So that kind of turned the table for me. So at the time I was actually studying for my MCAT, which is the entrance exam to get into medical school, like traditional medical school. I remember him looking at me and being like, oh, we're going to be arguing about a couple things, just kind of jokingly. And not that I'm against medical doctors or whatnot, but that kind of opened my eyes to how naturopathic medicine can be so beneficial to people. It's not hocus pocus witchcraft or anything like I've heard some people refer to it as.
Yeah.
But that was my first foray into it, and it kind of opened my eyes, and the rest was history. I think we're great, like I said, at taking a step back and looking at the big picture. I absolutely love that approach. And there's so much we can do for patients, so.
Yeah, it's super important. The big thing is just the time factor. I've never blamed medical doctors. I'm not against them, but they're limited in how much time they can spend with a patient.
Yep.
They can't go through all those thorough assessments that you were able to do when you saw him.
Yep.
That because they have to just stick to the billing of whatever OHIP. Yeah, OHIP, right? I mix up all these
all these acronyms.
What the government says that they have to stick to. And if they're not doing it, they can't keep their practice going. So it's not their fault. They're handicapped. They're a little bit handcuffed there. But
it also just deters the patient in general. Like, you go to, you see your general practitioner, you have an ache, a pain, an issue, and they look at you for 5 minutes, and then, you know, okay, send you to the next specialist, send you to imaging, and everything is just so prolonged. It ends up, like, even for me with my, you know, my injury and my lat and my rotator cuff, like, the amount of times I've just put it off just because by the time I get another image, by the time I get another ultrasound and go see this specialist and this specialist, it's really off-putting. And it's nice to hear that there is that alternative for someone to take that step back and say, okay, this is where it hurts, but it could be caused by this, this, and this. Like, even with my issue, I have a torn, my left lat is torn. And originally, I wasn't feeling, unless you poked it directly, I wasn't feeling any pain there. All of my pain was coming from my neck, my shoulder. I had, like, I was constantly pulling my neck. And then, over time, we started to realize that, okay, it was actually coming from my lat, not from where I originally felt it. So it's always nice to have that person take a few extra minutes and say, okay, listen, this is where you're feeling it, but maybe this is actually what's causing it, looking at other structures in the body.
That's awesome, yeah.
And just from your experience, because I can share my thoughts on this too, but how much can you determine just from doing physical assessments on people versus having to get the imaging done and saving, like, is it worth the time where they have to have this delay and get the imaging, or are you successful in finding things just through range of motion testing, muscle test, like strength testing and stuff?
Yeah. From a liability perspective, I'll never deter someone from going to get an imaging.
Absolutely.
100%. And they definitely can be helpful. Like, I wouldn't, like, if someone has an MRI schedule, I wouldn't be like, don't go, like, kind of,
yeah,
thing, right? But I always stress to people, like, the MRI will not show the causative factors. Regardless what that MRI says, whether let's say it's a herniated disc, say, okay, great, we know you have a herniated disc, how did it get there? Like, what are you doing that caused it? The MRI is not going to tell you that. We still need to identify that. So that's what I'll sort of go through with patients and explain to them. It's like, look, this can be very helpful, but it is not the be-all and end-all of what's going on. And on top of that, with imaging, there are studies out there that are saying just because something is on imaging, it doesn't necessarily correlate with the amount of pain you have.
Absolutely.
As you know. So like, whether it's osteoarthritis, rotator cuff tears, herniated discs, like there are people with 10% tears in their rotator cuff and they have all kinds of pain. There are people with full rotator cuff tears and they feel nothing, absolutely zero pain. So I want people to know that just because something says something on a imaging result doesn't necessarily mean it's going to correlate with what you're feeling.
Yeah.
So that's important to know too, for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I agree with you completely there with not saying don't go get imaging. It's good. Have it done.
Definitely.
Whatever you need to do. But yeah, I've seen stuff come back where I can visibly see the patient be discouraged because they get the results, they bring them into me, and like, oh, they said it was like mild arthritis in this joint, and they're in the worst pain. And I have to spend a good chunk of that visit reassuring them that, like, I believe your pain. I believe you're going through that pain. And it's way worse than what this imaging shows. But this imaging doesn't tell the whole picture. And it's frustrating because a lot of times they come to me because their doctor's like, well, no, there's hardly any arthritis or no arthritis at all, as an example. And like, you're fine. Just take Tylenol.
Exactly.
Yeah. Get past it. And that can be very frustrating where you're not taking into account stuff like this book, where it's muscle balances and tracking and different stuff like that, where it doesn't matter how much degeneration is, it doesn't correlate to how much pain someone can actually be in.
Well, it's also a lot of time it's positional too. When you go into an MRI, or like the first time I did my ultrasound for my neck and my back, they didn't find anything, and I have to say to them, like, when I'm like this, there is no pain. It's when my arm is above my head, that's when I can feel a pull, I can feel some strain. And it was only at that point that they actually noticed that there was a tear there, which I find, because as a patient, you know, if you're afraid to be aggressive with the person doing the test or doing the imaging and say, listen, like, we need to test further, or we need to try a different position, I feel like a lot of it gets missed. And especially if it's not an acute injury and it's chronic and over time, that's also where, yeah, you can see that there's a slip disc or a tear, but you don't remember how you got it, or there wasn't a specific point in when it happened. So, you know, all you're doing is just curing the symptoms of that original injury. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's a good point with the position, because it is just a snapshot. It's not like it's a moving thing that they're seeing. They're taking pictures in different planes to try to find something that they don't even know what they're really looking for until they see it.
Yeah.
It's a very tricky thing. But yeah, that's just side rant. I want to talk more about your book. So you told us it starts off with some fun stuff about like history of the butt.
Yeah.
Where does it go from there?
It goes into everything you can think of. It goes into the anatomy of your butt. So those who are interested, you can look at all the different muscles and nerves in there. Go ahead and flip
more
through.
More pictures of your diagram?
Yeah. Of my lovely behind. Yeah.
Look at that.
There's some
different ponytails.
Lots of pictures of butts in there for your viewing pleasure. Anything to do with the butt. So like I was saying, the anatomy of the butt. I talk about cellulite and what that might mean for all the ladies that are listening and some men involved.
Actually, to touch base on that, just because I know a lot of the clients listening would love to hear another person describe what cellulite actually is. Can you please explain that?
So this is a touchy subject for some people. The main thing I will say about cellulite is it is not your fault. Like people, I say women, but some men can have cellulite. Mm-hmm. You need to know that it's a natural process that kind of it happens. And there's so many different reasons for it underlying it. Hormonal, skin, there's so many different things. The main thing I touch on in the book, like I touch on a few strategies on how you can kind of mitigate some of it, but the main thing is don't feel body shamed because there's cellulite there. Like, it is a natural process that happens. I don't really want to expand on it that much more because I know we can go into a bit of a
we
got time. I love the chapter names of some of these, like last but not least.
Thank you.
Very clever throughout this whole thing.
We touch on Shakira's hips and how they definitely do not lie, and my hips absolutely lie, so I need to...
I've personally danced with Ryan. The hip movement, it can be improved upon.
Yes. Absolutely.
What are your big tips here for people that might be, or actually, you know what, before that,
yep,
talk to us more about what conditions can come. So you mentioned a few things, but I want people to really understand that it can start from the glutes and what other pains that can be associated with glutes being out of balance or stiff or any pelvis shift that you've been dealing with.
Yeah, the main thing I would say is obviously in today's society, we're sitting all the time. So that creates imbalances around the pelvis as well. So a lot of times people recognize like someone's shoulders are rolled forward. They have that typical upper cross syndrome, we call it, where the pecs are very tight, the upper back rounds, and you can kind of see people kind of rolling forward with their arms. The similar muscle imbalances can happen around the pelvis, and that can throw things off big time. Main symptom you will see because of that is low back pain. A lot of people don't make the connection between their hips and their glutes and low back pain, but I see it all the time. So if you're strengthening your glutes and you're addressing their not only appearance but their function, your low back pain will decrease. There's even, you can do this self-test at home if you want, and just press on your upper glutes really hard, and sometimes you'll feel like pain radiating up into your low back. There can be pain in your low back that is literally being radiated from your glutes and has absolutely nothing to do with your low back. So that's something to be aware of as well. But it's related to everything. From everything I see, I'm like, someone comes in to see me with an ankle sprain, and I'm like looking at their butt. They're like, why are you looking at my, I'm so confused. But once they see the results and like I explain things to them, they're like, oh, this actually makes sense. So it's, yeah, it's something I've developed a passion over. I've had people call me the butt doctor. But whatever you want to call it, I like looking at what's causing things and understanding their background, and it led me to this.
Question part of that then.
Yeah,
do you check a lot of leg length discrepancies?
I do, and that can be part of things. There are anatomical leg length discrepancies where it's just a true leg length issue, and there are sometimes things can be thrown off where, similar to me, my leg length got thrown off when my pelvis ended up shifting.
Mm-hmm.
So there can be functional reasons for that too, and yeah, that's definitely something to check for. A great point. And to correct.
Yeah, no, because in my patients, when they come in with low back pain, it's one of the first things that I'm looking for.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't find that they usually have a true leg length discrepancy. And when I say that, what I mean is like one leg is longer or at least appearing longer than the others.
Yes.
So basically you lie someone flat and check if their ankles line up when they're all relaxed. And I find a lot of times people have a slight, it's not off by a lot, but a little bit, where one ankle is just dropping a little lower than the other. And it's usually not like the bones being longer, but it comes back to the glutes and too tight on one side, pulling and shifting that pelvis just slightly.
Yes.
It doesn't have to be a big obvious thing. I mean, it sounds like with your soccer and everything, you're probably in a different league of how much you're shifted. But other people will have maybe just a slight shift from being one-sided, like right-legged or driving. That can cause a lot of sitting with their wallet in their back pocket for too long. And it can be off by a little. But over years, that pain adds up. And then, again, it's never really that it bent over and hurt their back picking something up.
Yes.
It's that the shift has happened, and it causes that long-term pain. But I'm glad there's people like you doing this stuff and explaining it. What else? What else about the book? What are some tips for people? What would you give, like, as a big butt tip?
Big butt tip?
I guess that came out. I don't know. Whatever tip you want to give.
What do you have, a massive butt tip for everyone? My main tip for pretty much everyone, but related or not, is be the type of person that asks the tough questions when it comes to your health. So when you go in to see someone, whether I gave that example before about a meniscus tear or ankle sprain or whatever, always ask tough questions about it to that practitioner. What could have been causing this? What can I do on my own? Like, be the type of person that wants to take onus of their health, and that's when I see the best results. Like, we can only do so much as practitioners when someone comes to see us for half hour twice a week. It's like, okay, I'm gonna put the onus on you. What are you doing on your own, kind of thing? Are you adjusting the height of your chair so your hips are sitting at the right level? Are you doing the strengthening exercises, the range of motion exercises, the mobility stuff like Rob talked about? That's my main advice. Like, you value your health and you invest in it, and you will see results. Like, that's the bottom line. And if you can get a great looking butt as a sort of side effect of that, then why not?
Not a bad side effect.
Yeah, exactly. Why not?
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually, because a lot of people think that everything has to be in the person taking care of them's hands, when a lot of it should be, and it is there, but to really get better, you have to put the work. There's no real two ways about it. You can only do so much, and you don't have unlimited funds. I mean, I'd love to treat somebody every day, but that's expensive.
Yes.
So they have to be doing stuff on their own, or else it's not going to work. You're like, two times a week is great.
Yep.
Can help a lot of people, but there's going to be a big chunk of people that just need the extra, even if it's a little bit, like a little tiny amount of it every other day. It'll make such a big difference, and it's that consistency. I try to tell everybody that consistency is the biggest part there, where it doesn't have to be a life-consuming thing. And I promise, there's apps, I think, on the phones that tell you how much screen time you spend.
Yeah.
I think where every time you like look at that phone, even just for a few seconds at a time, you could be saving your butt. Literally.
Think about your butt, people.
Yeah, it's hours a day that we spend doing stuff that doesn't matter or make us better, probably makes us worse, actually, because...
Yeah.
Probably not in great posture when we're looking at our phones.
Yeah.
and it's about prioritizing your own health, but taking that responsibility yourself.
Yeah, you made some great points. And like, my favorite patients to work with are the ones that are doing that stuff, and they're coming back to me like, you know what, I tried this one, it worked, this one wasn't the best, let's adjust it. Yep, no problem. And we sort of tweak our plan as we go. Those are the ones that always see the best results. And like, I can do soft tissue work to release your glutes. I can do acupuncture to help with some of the tension, but if like that will only go so far, and you have to be able to address those causative factors and be willing to invest in your own health, and you will see great results.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Are there any other topics we wanted to? Is there anything else about the book?
I don't know.
You're
guys.
Too good of a guest to just cut this podcast here.
Well, one of the things I'd like to kind of touch base on is as well as more from the performance side of things as you know, as a topic, what should someone really consider when in relation to obviously their butt in terms of performance? Like I mentioned before, I feel like it's one of the most skipped body parts to work out, especially for men.
Mm-hmm.
And even as a trainer who incorporates it in almost every class that and training program that I create, it's something that men consistently try to skip or avoid.
Right.
What is your take on that, and why, you know, our men listening should not be skipping glute days?
Yeah. So, glutes are obviously critical, and in pretty much any of my workouts that I recommend, there's always some sort of glute activation that's happening. People going for runs, you should be activating your glutes beforehand. People doing workouts in the gym, you should be activating your glutes beforehand. That's crucial because it's so involved in all the different movements that we do. One great thing to have assessed by someone who's qualified is your squat. I find it translates so well to all different dynamic sports movements. And a healthy squat will make for a healthy runner, a healthy soccer player, basketball player, whatever it is. So part of my book was putting in there a way that people could self-assess their own squat. And I even have a checklist in there where they can look through and say, okay, am I doing this? Am I doing that? And then they can kind of work through the program and then check their squat later and see how it improved.
Mm-hmm.
A squat is my favorite exercise by far. I find in gym circles it's starting to change a little bit. Like amongst the guys, it used to be like, oh, how much can you bench, bro? And now it's like, okay, how much can you squat or deadlift or whatever?
Yeah.
So it's starting to shift a little bit from what I've seen, but not as much as it should, kind of thing. So yeah, I'm sure you have experience working with people in their squats. Like it's,
oh, yeah.
You see differences for sure when people improve their squat.
Oh, and that's one of the reasons why I brought it up, and I was excited to have you here, is because I think it's no one really correlates their ability to squat or their lack of ability to squat to, you know, hip or glute tightness. And especially since we've opened up the wellness center here, and so many patients come through constantly, and then, you know, I get either you know, our physiotherapist Mark or Dr. Rapponi here relaying the message, okay, they're not activating their glutes, they're not activating their glutes, and it's something that I hear regularly, and I feel like this needs to be now projected towards everyone, you know, who's working out, everyone who's taking their fitness level seriously. they need to understand the relationship between their glutes and their overall fitness. So
yeah,
I'm glad that this exists, and I'm definitely going to be recommending this book to a ton of my my clients.
Awesome, yeah.
Why don't we actually, as a trainer and a butt doctor over here, why don't we break down what the most common mistakes someone will make on squats? Because it is an important exercise that is mm-hmm. often done wrong, and I think I treat more squat-related injuries than any other gym injury. Mm-hmm. So why don't we break it down? Tell us what we should be looking for. Go for it.
Firstly, it's foot position. So again, there's a ton of variations on squats, which, you know, as a trainer, yes, we like to experiment with different variations, different footwork, different foot positioning. But again, before you can really do that, or you should really do that, you should be able to master that standard squat. So positioning your feet around a little bit wider than shoulder width apart, having a slight pronation to your toes as well, making sure that as you're squatting, it's almost like how I like to teach it is like you're trying to sit on a chair. So you're forcing your bum back, keeping your knees behind your toes so that they're not, you know, pass, like you should be able to see your toes as you're squatting versus having them pass your toes so that all of a sudden your feet disappear. Your back should be nice and straight. Your chest should be out. Your shoulders should be pulled back, and your stomach should be contracted. And as you're going down, you're putting all your weight on your heels, making sure that as you're coming up, now you're pushing through your heels, from your heels to your hamstring, right up through your glutes, and then extending up from there.
What are your thoughts on how low people should be going for a squat? Because I always hear conflicting things. I personally don't even know what to believe because I've seen people have great results from doing either. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on that?
No. I'll take that one. If you can go below 90 degrees with good form, then I think it's okay. I think some people try and go lower than they should be and their body's not ready for it.
Okay.
So in order to be able to squat properly, we've obviously talked about hip strength and range of motion. There are so many different other ranges of motion that need to be there for you to squat properly. So sometimes you'll see people propping their heels up when they squat. Mm-hmm. If their calves are tight, they're just sort of compensating for that by doing that. So you need to have the right range of motion around your ankles and your calves. Even your mid-back is involved as well. And being able to maintain a neutral spine, neutral being the most optimal position for your spine or its most natural curvature. Yeah, and even like some people will be looking up at the sky as they squat. That's a no-no for me. Like you want to maintain those natural curves in your spine. I don't even remember what your question was.
Low can you go?
Oh, how low can you go? Yeah. So if your body is, if you have those prerequisite strengths and ranges of motion, then you can go pretty low. Below 90 degrees I'd be fine with, but for the most part, like, most people aren't there. They need work with strength and range of motion before they get to that point.
Excellent. So proper form, you can drop down a lot lower, but it has to be within your weight tolerance range. Yeah, often people go way too high in their weight.
Yeah, exactly.
There's also a general progression that you can do with squats that, again, people just like to jump to because they've been training for so long, regardless of how good they can actually squat. They generally feel, okay, I can lift, you know, 200 pounds in a squat. I can probably do this, that, and adjust it. But there is so many variations that you should be able to kind of check mark. Like, even through general, like, testing, you know, doing overhead squats, for example, holding a bar, bar or a dowel overhead, making sure that you can maintain proper posture while sitting through the squat.
That's one of the hardest exercises.
Extremely hard. And the funny thing is, it's not only is it extremely hard, but it's done with the stick that I use to test this. It's a piece of wood. It weighs nothing. Yeah. And you know, you give me that piece of wood versus a bar loaded with weights, and the piece of wood is harder than the bar 10 times out of 10. And again, it's because that positioning, and I find it also really shows me where the person is weakest and most tight. And it also gives me a complete, you know, guideline of, okay, these are the areas that I want to attack, and these are where I want to focus on in terms of their strength and conditioning and increasing their mobility.
Yeah, and the main thing with the dowel too is, like you said, you can't cheat. Like, it will expose your flaws and it'll do it quickly.
Yeah, that's so true. Yeah.
But I also like what you said about the variations of squats too, and not you can't really cross over if you get really good at like a standard squat with the bar on your back, free weight type of thing. If you get really good at that and then you want to change it up in any slight way, you cannot start with that same weight.
No.
It doesn't matter how strong you were in that one plane of motion.
Yeah.
You need to change that weight back to like you were just learning a new exercise and you've never done it before.
Well, especially because considering even as simple as weight position, you know, if you're going from a front squat to a back squat or vice versa, that weight is now being targeted on different muscles, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not just because the name is squat that it's the same thing. It's putting pressure on different areas that you have to make sure are equipped and able and capable of progressing through that range as well.
Yeah, I see it all the time where people say like, oh, my legs are strong. They're my strongest muscle thing, so I can do all this stuff. But if it's a different movement that mm-hmm. they're not used to, it's not going to be the same. Like, right. I played football with some friends on the weekend. I exercise. I didn't think I'd get as sore as I did. All I was doing was running, but my whole body hurt from top to bottom. It wasn't tackle football. It was just running and two-hand touch, and I'm never sore than when I play. It doesn't matter what my workout routine is. But that's an example. It's just a different movement. It doesn't matter if your muscles were strong before.
Yeah.
It's new.
Yeah.
Were you going to say something?
Maybe.
Sorry,
well, no. yeah, like, when you're training, whether it's squats or anything else, you need to be asking yourself, why am I doing this movement? So you asked before, like, should someone squat below 90 degrees? It's like, well, what are your goals? Like, does that fit in with what you want to do functionally? Like, it should always be translating to something.
Mm-hmm.
So if you, like, wanted to train a couple weeks in advance for your football, that happened this past
weekend.
Just
a few weeks.
Yeah. And we're doing specific exercise in order to prep you for that, then maybe you wouldn't have been as sore kind of thing. But, like, that's a silly example. But always ask yourself, like, what are your goals? And then train accordingly. Don't just squat to squat. That's another main message I'll tell people.
That's very good point.
Yeah,
especially if you're doing it for a sport, you don't need to be doing things that bodybuilders are doing.
Yeah.
If it doesn't match your sport.
Exactly.
While we're back on squats, though, I do have two more things I want to run by you. See what your thoughts are. Both of you. One, what are your thoughts on like barefoot or the toe shoe?
Oh,
I want to hear
your opinion on this. Yes. Oh, yeah.
Are you like a running shoe person or for squats specifically?
For squats specifically,
doesn't have to be the rest.
I am a flat shoe person.
Okay.
So I don't like the heels propped up on squats. It changes the mechanics on things. And when I teach squats as well, I'll teach people to have their feet relatively straight. Maybe a touch of feet pointing out is okay, but not much. And they should be, I'm going to stand up as I do this just because it's a little bit easier to explain.
Should record it too.
Yeah. Sorry. You should be trying to rip the floor apart between your feet is what I'll teach. So as you're turning outwards, you will feel your glutes activate and your hip socket or your femur, the head of your femur will sit in the socket a little bit more properly. So you get a bit more proper rotation. It's a bit hard to explain. I'm sure there are videos out there on it. You guys pulling out but it's
you can put a link in the description after.
Well, I talk about it in the book too. I'll show you some pictures.
Excellent.
In there. But that's how I teach a squat. I find I get more glute activation when you are activating even before you start to move. So you're creating that torque between your feet by screwing your feet into the ground in an outward motion, and that helps again activate the glutes and put your femur in the right place. Your question was about shoes, and I just went off on a...
No,
that's
I apologize, but yeah.
So would there be a benefit to having either barefoot... I see people throw off the shoes all the time when they're doing squats or wearing... I myself have a pair of the finger-toe shoes.
I've seen those, yeah.
Just to see what they would be like, and I wanted to try them out. But do you find that they would have an advantage over just a flat shoe, or you prefer the flat shoe?
Either or would be fine as long as it's flat for me, and you can create that torque. So if you're in socks, you won't be able to create that torque by screwing your feet into the ground.
So you need grip.
Yeah, so you need grip, in my opinion, to do a proper squat.
Okay.
So that's how I'll teach it. And then we were talking about before flat shoes and the heel being propped up as like a way to cheat kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the reason I don't like the high heeled shoes essentially. Like we've gone like centuries and centuries wearing either barefoot or like now all of a sudden like big companies are telling us we need these big heels to support us as we run. It's like, do we really need these? I don't know, right?
Yeah. Well, you see a lot of tight calves and everything. The exaggerated version is the high heel.
Yeah.
So many women have so many problems with their legs because of high heel shoes, and that's a bit accentuated. But, the small heel makes a bit of a difference there, too. So you wouldn't do squats in, like, running shoes that are kind of padded for heel strike. And I think you have an opinion on heel strike. I think we talked about this back in the day, too, if you want to get into that.
I'm curious because now even myself, I've heard so many different opinions on actually, funny enough that you brought up heel strike, too, on heel strike running and also with squatting, whether or not it should be barefoot, and then my opinion on actual squat shoes.
That's exactly
there's companies who've literally come out and created shoes specifically for squatting. And because I've now been asked the same question on so many different occasions, and it's everyone always has their own opinion on it, I find it very difficult to kind of give a solid answer without kind of misleading people a little bit, because yes, I think that there is something to be said about us, for centuries we ran barefoot, and we didn't have any shoes initially. Why all of a sudden do we have them now? But I also think now our lifestyles have also changed, right? So I think we've already, our body, our mechanics are definitely different than what they were, our ancestors anyways, because of our environment and because of the things we do now. Like, we sit way more than they did, and we sit in a chair versus crouching down. And so I would like to hear your opinion on it, because I certainly would love to give people more of a definitive answer.
Mm-hmm.
So what would you
specifically, what do you want me to
let's touch on the, so you already touched on the shoes, and
yeah,
and can you actually give, I know I'm gonna give this link to a few of my clients right after.
Yeah.
Why flat versus like a running shoe?
So I just find it's a way to cheat when your heel is propped up when it comes to the squat. Like, I'll see people do it, and it's sort of a way they graduate towards a more difficult squat, which is fine, but mm-hmm. they'll literally put their feet on like 45-pound plates.
Yeah.
So their heel is elevated, which to get more depth, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Why not just improve your range of motion around your ankles in order to do that kind of thing? I know it's a way to kind of graduate into a more difficult squat, so I see the functionality behind it. But to have that built-in heel where you're essentially just cheating the whole time, I'm not a fan of it. First, we're talking just squatting purposes.
Yeah, because even like from a trainer's perspective, especially when we're taught progressions in squats,
yep.
one of the things we do is, okay, we first do that initial test. How is your squat?
Exactly.
And then, like, what we're supposed to do is game plan from, okay, your squat is terrible and you have very little range of motion. How are we going to progress you to a regular squat? So we'll use things like weights to elevate the heel.
Right.
Always as an end, a means to an end, where we're taking those away.
100%.
But it's a good point that you make about the actual heel and the shoe. I don't even think I've ever thought of that myself as it elevating my heel while I'm squatting.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Have either of you used the I need to remember the name of these shoes.
The toe shoes?
Yeah, the toe shoes. We just keep calling them toe shoes.
Yeah.
Have you tried them yourself?
I've never worn a pair. No,
I know our chiropodist would have a very opinionated, she hates them. Because I brought them in and I was all like ready, happy to show her, and then she's like, what are you doing? I find that, okay, so I tried running in them and it was horrible because there's definitely no support on the heel. I don't recommend them for running at all. It's exhausting. It's all toe heel.
Yeah.
And I was building up to do longer distances and it was very painful. And I did start slow. I didn't want to kill myself. I know that there's injuries that are all kinds if you've never ran that way before. But it wasn't fun. In the gym, though, I really liked them. I found, mostly because I don't like wearing socks if I don't have to, so those are nice. You don't have to wear socks in them. You can throw the whole thing in the washing machine after. But I liked the feeling of my feet and toes being able to kind of grip the ground for different things. I did like them a lot for squats. There is still the rubber, so they're still grippy, but there's not any padding, so it's all your foot there. But I don't know. I want you guys to just try them and see.
Yeah, I would like to try them.
Same.
I don't know that they were better or worse, but I did like doing like the boot camp classes here at the gym. I liked them better in those shoes than running shoes. I find that I'm more aware of what I'm stepping on and everything, especially when you're doing like box jumps, tire jumps.
Yeah.
I just find that I have that extra sensation of where my feet are, and I won't slip and not that I'm slipping and falling everywhere in like regular shoes, but I do like that.
Yeah, you have
a grip of my toes. I just like being barefoot. So it worked for me. I don't know if it worked for everybody, but I wanted to see if there was a problem with it. Again, I have seen some research on them, and if you go into them too hard too quickly, lots of injuries that come of it. But then there's also the flip side where if you strengthen that arch because you're using your feet more for balance and grip, it can have some positive benefits. But I'm glad we talked about that. It was a good side.
Nice tangent, yeah.
But I'm also glad that you said about the like cheating with the heel raise, because that brings me to my other squat question for both of you.
Yep.
What do you think of belts? Like core, what do they call it? The belts that people wear for like really heavy tacos.
Now, I'm not sure if we're going to have the same opinion on them. Actually, maybe. I think we would. If you're a power lifter, if you're lifting astronomical amounts of weight, then you know what, to save yourself, like for my first bit of advice for you being a power lifter is stop. my second advice in that case would be definitely wear a belt, wear knee guards, wear you name it, put a helmet on, for God's sakes, whatever you need to do to keep yourself as safe as possible in that situation. If in terms of regular fitness and regular training, if you need a belt, and don't get me wrong, I've put a belt on. I don't regularly, but I have when I'm ego training. And that's when I'm suggesting wear a belt, is when you're ego training, which you should never do.
Yeah.
If you can't lift the weight properly with your, like using your own body and it with proper form, then it's too heavy for you. Just because you can do a squat doesn't mean you're squatting biomechanically correctly. If you're struggling and you need assistance, you're doing it wrong. And I would love to hear your...
Yeah, you were right. We have essentially the same opinion on those. Most of my athletes or the people I work with are soccer and hockey players, and we're never getting to the point where they would need a belt anyways. Mm-hmm. We're working so much on core strength, and we're not working to the point where we're pushing to the point where they would need a belt, essentially. So
I'm very opposed to them, except for I like that you brought up like the powerlifting and stuff. It's not a easy sport to be in if you're doing that, sure, but for anybody else, I don't care how much you're lifting in the gym, I don't think you should be wearing one, because you need to have your core strong.
That's exactly it.
To be working on that proper form with the glutes and everything, like if you need that belt to lift more weight, then the weight's not the right weight.
Exactly.
For you.
And that's
core,
a good,
is so important.
Yeah, and that's a great point. I didn't even touch base on that. Like, that's a huge point, is that it takes away from your core activation. You're not tight, the belt's tight. And I think that'll actually reduce your ability to squat properly. You could be squatting 400 pounds, but you take the belt off, and then what happens to that squat after?
Right? Exactly. Pulled in half. Yeah,
that's exactly it. Yeah.
I don't like it because it gives you that false sense of strength and security, but then that's going to lead to more back pain anyway, because now you're exactly what this book is probably is telling you here, where you're going to get your quads, maybe your hamstrings, really strong, but now you haven't used your core, and you're going to throw off the alignment of everything there, because that core is going to be pulling in different ways or not pulling in the right ways. Anyway. And you're going to throw off your low back. Everything's going to hurt way more just because you were taking out that exercise you could have been giving to your core. The reason squats are so good is that they're a full body exercise.
Yeah.
And if you're taking out the biggest chunk of muscle in your body from having to do anything, and then it's not the same exercise. I don't like them. I'm glad that we talked about. Good. Anything else? That was fantastic. I think that was a very informative. Maybe one of our most...
Yeah.
Very specific and informative podcast. Dr. Ryan's been great. We need to have you back on.
For sure.
I had a great time. I'll be back anytime you want.
Perfect. We'll hit up some other topics. And I think any closing remarks? We all
No, I just wanted to say thank you so much for coming. We really appreciate it. As our regular viewers are aware, he is our first guest, so we're very excited to have him. And yeah, that's basically it.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks for listening. Thanks for coming in.
No problem.